from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Benghazi, the word itself, the place name, has become a stick of dynamite, a dividing line, a symbol. What really happened that night when U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three more Americans died in Libya? That's the story told by writer Mitch Zuckoff and surviving members of a security team that rushed to the U.S. diplomatic compound on the night of September 11, 2012. This hour On Point, the story from the ground in Benghazi. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you still looking for answers from Benghazi? Have you moved on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will go to the president's strategy on ISIS to be laid out for the country this week. But first, Benghazi. Joining me now in the studio is Mitchell Zuckoff, author and professor of journalism at Boston University. His new book, written with the CIA Annex security team stationed in Benghazi at the time of the attacks, is 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. Mitch Zuckoff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Why does this still matter? I mean, we've gone around and around and around on Benghazi. But here you are with a new story out. Paramount signed it for a movie. I know it's got drama. You portray it as a kind of Alamo in the Libyan desert. But why, beyond the drama and the heroics, and they are real, and I read them here, why does this story still matter at this point? And I don't mean to echo Hillary Clinton. You know, what does it matter? But why does this story that you're telling matter now?
It's the right question, Tom. And the reason why it matters is because it seems to me half the country considers this a major scandal of constitutional proportions, and the other half thinks of it as purely partisan noise. And none of them know exactly what happened on the ground to make a judgment of their own in terms of how this matters. How is this preventable? What can we learn from it? This was a frontline battle between Islamist extremists and America. And is that not relevant now? Of course it is. We also don't know yet, until you read this book, the full role of the contractors, these hired guns who have taken the role of American military officers around the most dangerous points of the globe. So there's so much yet to be known and understood that this still matters very much so.
We should say that this is a book written with a half dozen nearly of those contractors who cooperated with you in putting the story together.
That's correct.
But still, you're telling the on-the-ground situation here, and nobody was, well, except sadly for those who were in the diplomatic compound, those who died, nobody was closer to this than these guys.
That's correct.
But the controversy, has it really been about what happened on the ground? I mean, it was about, were they prepared? Was security adequate? It was about, did they botch the response? Should we have sent in more military? It was about, has been about, because it's not over, it has been about how what happened was presented to the country and the world. Are the events of that night on the ground really the source of the huge political controversy that's erupted out of this?
I think, Tom, it's been mixed together. The talking points afterward and the discussion of the movie clips have been all melded together and turned into a big conglomeration of scandal in some people's eyes. But we can't understand how that works until we understand what happened first. And I think the big stories and some of the big takeaways do involve, just as you were just saying, the security issues beforehand. And now we see it in a new light when we understand what the CIA was there and how their compound was and what happened when the guys were delayed and who told them to wait. And so all these different points did get merged together into the after effects, into the aftermath of what happened that on the Sunday talk shows. I think we can separate them, and I think we have to take them one at a time and understand them and then decide, is the politics, you know, are the politics real?
Let's hear the story you found. It is gripping in its own right. There's no doubt about that. This is September 11th, anniversary 2 years ago, coming up this week, 2012, in Benghazi. Americans have two compounds, at least, I guess, but anyway, two in Benghazi. One, the formal, open, acknowledged diplomatic presence there,
yes,
where Ambassador Chris Stevens was visiting from Tripoli, the
correct
capital. Two, about a mile away.
A little under.
A smaller CIA compound where your guys are, who you've written this story with. And this is, what, a half dozen former Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Marines.
Correct.
They tend to be 40-something at this point, late 30s or 40. They got real estate businesses back in the States, whatever. They're moonlighting or bringing in extra cash by picking up that gun again, becoming hired contractors. On that night, what happened?
Well, first, the story really, of course, begins at the diplomatic compound. It's been a quiet day, despite it being 9/11. Chris Stevens has stayed in the compound the entire day just to be safe. But it's so quiet that even as late as 7:30 that night, he's able to walk outside the compound to say goodnight to his last guest.
Within 2 hours, all hell would be breaking loose.
Correct. So he's 9:30. He's back inside the villa, writing in his diary about how happy he is to be back in Benghazi. It just feels good there. He had been there during the revolution or prior to the revolution.
This is an ambassador who is kind of a man of the people. He likes to press the flesh and listen and talk directly to Libyans.
Absolutely. He's a man on the ground. And so just after that, 9:42, the diplomatic security agents are scattered around relaxing. One happens to be in the command center. He looks at the he hears a noise and he looks at the monitor and sees a couple of dozen armed men rushing through the front gates of the compound. There's been no alarm. The local guards they've hired have melted away without even firing a shot or alerting anyone. He immediately hits the drop and cover alarm. Everyone scatters because the diplomatic security agents only have their sidearms.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly we have the Americans on the diplomatic compound divided into three different buildings and only one diplomatic security agent with the ambassador and Sean Smith, the communications expert, in a small safe haven.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And so they're just trying to hunker down, and they make a call out to my guys.
So no advance warning, no protests during the day,
absolutely
nothing to say,
not.
Here comes a storm.
Absolutely.
But the storm
not.
Comes right through the gate, a couple of dozen right away, and more would soon follow.
Correct.
The call goes nearly a mile to the CIA annex. What do they say?
They said, we've been hit. And Alec Henderson, who's one of the DS agents inside the command center, gets on his cell phone and calls them and calls Tripoli. And immediately, the guys at the annex, the CIA annex, they jock up in their parlance. They put on their heavy gear, which is always within arm's reach.
But we're talking fast. Within 5 minutes or so, they're in their
maximum
cars.
They are
and you describe them. They've got their arms. These are former Navy SEALs, former Rangers. These are tough, experienced guys.
In their words, they're ready to rock and roll.
But in a hurry. I mean, one of them isn't even out of his short pants.
That's right.
But he's ready to go.
That's right. Tonto, who we'll hear from later, is wearing cargo shorts. And they're sitting in the
so
car.
So what? Let's go.
They're ready to go. They're fully armed. And the cars, the windows are steaming up because they're hot.
This
and they're
is
ready.
A dark BMW and a Mercedes SUV. They've got run flat tires. So even if they get shut out, they can go. They've got bulletproof windows.
Correct.
And they could be there within
A minute or two.
A minute or two.
Absolutely.
These are crucial minutes.
And they want to go. And they're saying, we've got to go because they're military experts. The guys in the CIA annex, they're intelligence gatherers.
Yeah.
But these guys, they're sitting there saying, we are losing the initiative. They're going to harden their positions. They're going to dig in. And it's going to be harder to go save the people we need to save.
The big headline out of your book so far has been that at that crucial moment when maybe they could have turned this thing around, put a cork in it right away, they were stopped by the CIA chief right there who said, no, hold for 20, 25 minutes.
That's correct. Ostensibly, the CIA base chief, who is identified only as Bob, he is, of course, an intelligence officer, and he is telling them, no, we're coordinating with the local militias, which is mind-blowing as we look back on this.
Well, but I mean, from his perspective, what he wanted the local Libyan militias, who had agreed to be America's security backup there, to come in and do this.
Yes.
That way you don't put more American lives at risk, that you don't have Americans shooting at Libyans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see his logic.
You can see his logic, but, you know, you talk to these guys who I wrote the book with, and they understood that the 17 February Martyrs Brigade was completely unreliable.
This was the backup, supposed to be backup local militia.
Correct. And that they knew they weren't going to be able to count on these guys. And they didn't know, you know, as they put it, you know, what's the difference between a Libyan when he's coming to help you and he's coming to kill you? You can't tell much difference. And that's how they felt, and that proved to be correct. And as this time is passing, these guys with their military training, now Bob is not a military commander.
He's the CIA chief.
But he is acting as a military commander.
Yeah, yeah.
And this time that's lost is frankly, is deadly for Chris Stevens and Sean Smith.
They're going nuts in their cars waiting to get going, and at last they just blow out of there. Why?
They're hearing radio calls. They're on the same radio frequency as the guys in the diplomatic security compound. And they're hearing, they're setting fires. If you don't get here, we're going to die. That's the quote that they finally say, we are going to break command. We are going to, we're leaving anyway. They look at each other through the glass of the car, the two vehicles, and they go.
They've waited how many minutes exactly at that
approximately
point?
Approximately 20 or so minutes of ready to go.
And off they go to the diplomatic compound where, by this point, more Libyans have gathered.
Correct. And so it's immediately, just as they feared, it's harder for them to even get there. They get to the corner of a street they call Gunfighter Road and this gravel road leading to the diplomatic security annex and compound. And they have to fight off people who are shooting at them.
Sure.
And one of them has to use grenades to actually clear a path to the front of the compound.
But they do that.
They do. And they break into two teams. Three go in through the front gate and three go around the back. Two go around the back with a translator and with others. And so now they're trying to just get
in. So six guys against how many Libyans are gathered at this point?
At this point, dozens. And who've already set fires. They are well armed. We know they have used rocket propelled grenades to open the door of the main villa. They are, and it's dark.
Ambassador
in there.
Stevens is in the safe room, but there's a fire. The smoke is becoming a problem here.
That's correct. And so these guys, and we have to sort of take a moment and respect the heroism of what these guys did to go in there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happened on the ground with the CIA security team in Benghazi on that night, September 11th, 2012, 2 years ago this week, and looking at how or whether Benghazi matters now. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it. A special committee in the House on Benghazi due to crank up again next week. The chairman of that committee, Republican, of course, in the House, saying that, their investigation will surely go into 2015 and maybe into 2016 if they don't get all the cooperation they want. That is maybe a big deal for Hillary Clinton if she runs for president. This is certainly going to be pushed right into the center of the table. But what really matters here, as Hillary Clinton almost said herself. Mitch Zukov is with us, author with the security team that was stationed there in Benghazi on that night, author of 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. Senate hearing on Benghazi all the way back in January last year, Republican Senator Ron Johnson asked then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about ascertaining whether the Benghazi attack was the result of a protest. Clinton gave her now famous or infamous response.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
Mitch Zukov is with me in the studio. We're going to hear in a moment from one of the contractors who was there that night in the thick of the fighting. How does then Secretary of State Clinton's question resonate with you, Mitch, having looked so closely at this? The issue in point was whether this grew out of a protest on that day. Her response has come to stand for a kind of a broader pushback against the very high flame of anger over Benghazi in many of his details. How does her question resonate with you? What does it matter?
Well, it matters, Tom, because as she said, frankly, in the last half of her comment, we have to figure out what happened to find out if this can be prevented, the next Benghazi, because there's no question that there are people around the world who want to carry out attacks like this on American interests. And so the first half of her comment certainly was, I think, inopportune, to say the least. But it does matter because we have to understand what were the security failures beforehand, what were the actions that failed during, and why. And this is where, again, people have lost it. That where were our intelligence failures beforehand? Why didn't we understand what the circumstances were in Benghazi? We were so focused on finding al-Qaeda in Libya that we didn't understand that the local militias down on the ground who had perhaps al-Qaeda-like leanings, who weren't officially affiliated, were thinking about doing these things, whether it was sparked by an Islamic, anti-Islamic film or by something else, or simply the opportunistic moment of September 11th to, being the anniversary. And And we didn't understand that. And you know, there's been some wonderful reporting. David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times mm-hmm. has done on the ground examining that. And so those things do matter. You know, one thing I try to keep in mind is, you know, the Battle of Mogadishu took place in 1993. We don't learn,
talking Black Hawk Down.
Which the book comes out in 1999. Mm-hmm. 6 years later, we're still trying to understand how this happened, both militarily and diplomatically and in terms of intelligence, of why this happened, why these men died, and what those implications are for us going forward.
Did your six guys, the security team, and again, these are almost all of them, retired U.S. military.
Correct.
Former U.S. military. Did they see this coming? Were they stunned?
They were not stunned. They had gotten what they call a BOLO, a Be on the Lookout report. They knew, you know, it was not specific to Benghazi, but they were constantly on the lookout. They felt they were vulnerable. They knew that Benghazi was rife with people who wanted to kill them, and so they did it. You know, these guys are you know, pretty macho guys, and they would joke about it, saying, you know, I got a bad feeling about this. They were mm-hmm. constantly saying this to each other because that was the feeling there, and so they knew they had intelligence that the Ansar al-Sharia militia had moved into a compound very close, almost next door to the American diplomatic compound. Mm-hmm. They knew that when they went around, they would see al-Qaeda-inspired flags flying from buildings. Mm-hmm. They knew and they felt they could not trust those militiamen who that the diplomats were looking to as the backup. Mm-hmm. And so they were definitely not surprised by this.
Did they have a chance once they arrived? 20 minutes later than they would have liked, 20 crucial minutes, but
yes.
Did they feel they had a chance to turn this around? What did they find?
Well, they found a burning compound. The buildings are on fire, diesel smoke, noxious fumes, and they get to the main villa and they meet up with a couple of DS agents, the diplomatic security guys, and they say the ambassador and Sean Smith are missing. And so they immediately plunge into this burning building and go in search after search, trying to find Ambassador Chris Stevens and Sean Smith.
Are they having to fight their way in, or they still have a clear running room there?
At this point, they still have clear running room. The initial attackers, during those 20 minutes, mm-hmm. they've accomplished the first phase. They've set these fires, and they have fallen back. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of time. There are bullets flying a little bit, somewhat, in some areas, mm-hmm. but they do have some room to do some of these searches. And again, heroically, these guys are like firefighters without the equipment or the training, mm-hmm. going into this burning building, trying to find Chris Stevens. And that's not working.
They knew where the safe room was. They knew he was in it.
They did. They knew he was somewhere in there, but it was dark. It was filled with noxious mm-hmm. diesel fumes, mm-hmm. and they couldn't get to the farthest reaches. They do get to Sean Smith, and they pull him out with the help of the DS agents, and tragically, he has died of smoke inhalation. So they know he's gone, but they can't find the ambassador. And as this time is passing, the attackers are massing again, and they hear reports, and they hear fire, and they know our time's up here. We have to get the survivors out of here. And so they send the diplomatic security agents out back to the mm-hmm. CIA annex mm-hmm. to take refuge while they fight off the attackers one incredibly dramatic moment, one of them, Tig, goes up to the roof of the villa and actually has to take out a guy with a rocket-propelled grenade who's about to blow them up.
But they can't hold it.
They can't. And they don't want to hold it. At that point, they feel like there's nothing they can do. If the ambassador is still inside, he's most likely dead. And they fear at one point that he may have been kidnapped. The goal now is we have to get ourselves back to the annex and then regroup and figure out what our next move is. So they head back to the CIA annex, which is a hardened facility, very unlike the diplomatic facility. Mm-hmm. They have staged fighting positions. They have ammunition in place. They have rooftop towers.
They have sandbags right in the front yard.
They're ready for action because these guys are trained for mm-hmm. that, and they made sure that they would have that protection. And so then what happens is over the course of this night, they're calling for help. They're looking for a Black Hawk or a Spectre fighting gunship.
Did they think that could be on the way?
They hoped it was close
enough to get there in these few hours?
They thought it was. They mm-hmm. thought it was. Now, the Department of Defense has said there were no assets within reach, mm-hmm. But the guys were hoping against hope that if they had a Spectre gunship, that would just clean this whole thing out. But they knew after a while they could only rely on themselves and each other.
Mitch Zuckoff is author, along with the annex security team of contractors in the CIA facility there in Benghazi on that night, of the new book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. With us right now from New York, Mitch, stand by here in the studio, is one of the contractors who was there that night, one of the six former contract operators who responded on September 11th, 2012. Chris Tanto Paranto is with us, former member of the Army 75th Ranger Regiment. Chris Paranto, Tanto Paranto, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks a bunch. It's an honor. I really appreciate it. It's never my wildest dreams, I think, I'd be on your show. I really appreciate it.
Is it important to you and the other survivors of that night? Because, of course, there were deaths.
Sure.
Is it important to you that this story be told? And if so, at this point, Chris, why?
My feeling is it's to honor the guys. It's to honor, you know, Ty and Bub, the guys that died. It's the truth. It's been so twisted and politicized and that it's become where it turned into the deaths of my friends and, you know, the injuries of my friends and our it's been turned into an agenda. And we didn't want that. We just wanted to tell the truth. And hopefully with the book and people reading the book, they can see that what a contractor actually goes through.
Chris, what is the twisting that you've seen in these 2 years since that night that has most bothered you? Twisting in what direction? Toward what story?
You know, it doesn't, not just the story itself and the truth not coming out, saying, you know, whether it be due to a video or whether saying that there was no stand down or just even just the actual story. So I've even heard on some when I was first got back home that we were made up, we were fictionalized, that we didn't exist, that there was no security team from the annex, and I don't remember the radio show that I heard it on.
Yeah.
And it really did bother me, but we sat on it because I actually worked longer, actually did for more contracts after because I enjoyed the job. But it did stick in you, especially when you see your friends die in front of you. Now, I've seen deaths before this, but this was a little different.
I'm trying to get a sense of where your criticism falls most heavily, Chris, on the twisting, as you call it, afterward. Are you saying it was twisted by the administration? Are you saying it was twisted by the administration's critics?
You know, both sides. I don't see it. I don't have any criticism. I'm not a politician. I don't have any criticism. My opinion, honestly, should not, and it does not go up to the administration in there. No, I don't have that room. I'm a guy on the ground. And so it's just the story itself, I think, on both sides have just tried to use it to their advantage, you know, and tried to use it to
politicize it.
Thank you. Thank you for the word. I'm sorry. Rangers don't have a great big vocabulary.
Hey, no, Rangers speak in many ways. What was
Rangers lead the way, Tanta.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's just, honestly, to me and the guys, it's just telling the truth and telling the story. And I'll go back to it, you know, 100 times. It doesn't matter if I'm asked the question 100 times. It's honoring those that I serve with. I'm so proud of those guys, and I'm so proud of what took place that evening, and I'm proud that we all stood together and decided to come out and tell the truth. And whatever the truth is, in whatever direction it takes it to, that's how it goes.
What was
there's no agenda that we have that we want to go.
Fair enough. What was the most challenging moment of that terrible night in Benghazi?
The waiting. Oh, definitely the waiting. Because I am friends with Scott. I am friends with Dave. I'm friends with Alec, the Department of State agents, and to hear them. Come on, guys, we need you. Come on, guys, we need you. Hey, they're lighting the buildings on fire. Hey, they're shooting. We need your help now. And just sitting there and revving the engines and being like, okay, we need to go. Why are we waiting? Why are we waiting? Now, that to me is just your heart's sinking because you're like,
yeah,
dang.
These are the minutes that you need. Mitch Chukov, where did that stand down order come from? Was that Bob on the ground, the CIA chief on the ground making his own decision? Was it coming down from the heavens from Washington?
We know that Bob was on the phone and in contact with Tripoli, and we believe Washington as well. But by all indications, and at this point, it seems to be a decision that he made. But that's one of those questions. That's why we're asking these questions. And when, you know, I imagine Tonto's going to be called to testify, and he's going to talk about this, and the congressional committee has to get to ask Bob, who were you talking to that night, and did you make the decision yourself?
Chris, Tanto Paranto, where do you think that order was coming from? Did it look to you as if Bob was struggling there? He didn't want to put your lives on the line. He wanted to bring in the local militia and spare you, or have more numbers to fight there. What?
I didn't see anything as far as facial expressions that gave me the indication that he was struggling to make a decision on it. All I got was, it was very blank. It was wait. due time. You know, hey, we need to go. We need to go now. Looking right through me to our team leader and him saying, wait, no, wait.
You've had 2 years to think about it. What do you think he was thinking?
You know, it's now, granted, it's an agency base. I wish I could say I knew what he was thinking. I don't know. I think it goes back to, like Mitchell said earlier, and I listened to it. Mm-hmm. Mitchell said earlier, there's military tactics and there's intelligence. Not having that that military experience, I think the decisions probably, and using an intel experience, he wasn't making good military decisions, which he shouldn't, and I don't expect him to.
Tonto has taught me is that, you know, the one thing they learn in the military is the worst thing you can do is not to make a decision.
And make a decision.
And the failure to make a decision, certainly by someone, caused this terrible delay.
Was he trying not to blow cover? Was this an undercover annex?
All annexes are some respect. I mean, that's who we work mm-hmm. for. They've got to be. Mm-hmm. Were they not? Was it not known in the city, sir? When you have Americans or people that don't look local driving in and out of a compound for a year
with sandbags in the front yard.
you could only stay covert for so long. Mm-hmm. So to answer that question, I don't know. Tell me. I want to know. Somebody tell me why. And you know what? I'll leave it at that. And we have got an answer. I heard you talking to Mitchell about this as well, mm-hmm. that it was waiting to coordinate with 17 February militia. Well, the first 5 minutes, I'll give you that. I understand it. But after that, minutes and seconds means lives, obviously. And that's what happened.
Do you think Ambassador Stevens could be alive today if you had those extra minutes?
Yes.
Or did it look to you like too late anyway?
No. Yes. No. No. The reason I believe that is because, first of all, he didn't die of an IED or getting shot or a grenade. He died of smoke inhalation. That takes time. If we had gotten there earlier, and we can what if an armchair quarterback it all day. But this, yeah, if you're asking about my demons that I think about at night, yes, I say yes, because we could have gotten there. We pushed them off. We could have got in there and gotten there quicker to get him and Scott, which Scott did a remarkable job, Scott Wicklin. I unbelievable what he was trying to do. And get them out. Yes, of course. If he was shot or if he was blown up, Maybe I would have a different answer. But being because it was smoke inhalation, and that takes time, you don't die right away with smoke inhalation. Yes, I believe we could have saved him and Sean.
Mitch, how are you able to track the stand down order? Do you think that originated with Bob on the ground there in Benghazi, so-called Bob, or it came down from on high?
I don't pretend to have unique knowledge of what happened in Tripoli and what happened in Washington, Tom. I think that's one of the reasons why this story still does matter, because we don't have that answer and we need that answer. And by all indications and by all the people I have talked to about that, they do suggest it came on the ground by Bob in consultation with Tripoli and Washington. But until I hear that firsthand, the way I heard these guys' story firsthand, I think we all deserve that answer.
Chris Tonto, I've just got you for half a minute. If Hillary Clinton runs for president in 2016, should this be a big issue in that campaign season or not?
It's going to be, whether I say it should be or not. But with politics, I don't know politics, Tom. I'm not a politician. So,
are you done soldiering now?
I am officially done, yes. I don't think I'll ever work for the government again. So it's hard, but if something comes up and my buddies need me, I'm there. They just have to ask me, and I'm there.
Chris Tonto Paranto with us from New York, one of six former CIA contract operators, all ex-military, who were there that night in Benghazi. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Paranto.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happened on the ground with the CIA security team in Benghazi on that night, September 11th, 2012. Hearings on this are about to gear up again in Congress. A special committee there that has said those hearings may well go well into the 2016 campaign season. Many are finished with this story. Many others are not finished with this story. It's going to be a political factor for Hillary Clinton if she runs for the presidency. A new book lays out in a kind of detail we have not seen before what happened on the ground. That is part of the story. We're looking at it this hour. Is this the biggest story in the world right now? Well, with everything else going on, maybe not, but it may be key in American politics going forward, and it does tell us something about chain of command and security at American facilities in this troubled part of the world. Mitchell Zuckoff is with us, author of 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. I say co because he had a lot of cooperation here with the security team itself. We just heard from one of them who were on the ground. He joins me in the studio. Mitch, a lot of questions, callers for you. Mary in New Orleans. Mary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for doing a show on this topic, and thank you to the author for writing the book. I think it is a topic that is very relevant and should remain alive.
Why?
Because it was, to me, a national catastrophe and disaster. Here we have people over there, and I know that sounds dramatic, but here we have people over there representing us, and they called for help weeks in advance, according to what the stories initially came out in the media. And there was no fortification given to them. We all know that they are in a very dangerous area. And when they do call for heightened security, hey, they're, you know, they were setting up camp settlements across the way from them, that something should have been done. And what concerned me is that when they did the hearings, Hillary Clinton, basically her demeanor, her words, were basically, let's just kind of sweep this out of the way. It was almost like, I'm on my way to the presidency. I've got bigger fish to fry. You know, dadgummit, this has just happened, and I don't need this, you know, in my repertoire. And it was almost like she just wanted it to go away. And me, as an American citizen, looking at their families and how upset everyone was with the basic information that was out at the time, it just would have come across so much better with more empathy, more interest, more let's get to the bottom of this, being more dogmatic about this situation instead of this fly needs to quit buzzing in my ear. I think it does need to be a centerpiece for this upcoming election because it has to do with a lot of leadership, response to a leadership, and knowing what's going on the ground and being a part of that.
Mary, we've got it. I think we've got it very clearly, your perspective here. I want to hold that. I'll bring it to Mitch. Let me get another, if I may. Mary, you are on the record.
Larry, thank you, Mary.
Yeah, Larry in Middlefield, Connecticut. Larry, you're on.
Hey, how are you? Well, I've got a different view. I believe it's a dead issue, and no pun intended.
Okay.
And I understand the Rangers and everybody there in a gung-ho attitude. I'm a former Marine. I was a Marine security guard in the Middle East back in the early 70s during the Kissinger trips.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dangerous place. These people volunteer to be there. They receive extra money for being there. They have contract security there because it's a dangerous place. And they put their lives on the line, and sometimes they lose them. You know, I don't know if, in fact, that extra 20 minutes would have made a difference. There's no Ranger, there's no SEAL I know that wouldn't think they could make a difference. But I'm not sure if, in fact, they could have or there would have been more lives lost.
Should this be a significant issue in the 2016 campaign, Larry?
No, it certainly won't be to me. I've seen the diplomatic community.
Yeah.
You know, this is part of, it's like, you know, and I don't want to minimize their losses.
By no means.
Shame we lost them.
But don't politicize it. Larry, we've got that one as well. I'll get one more mention and come to you. One more. Atlanta, Georgia. Mike, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, really, my question is, you know, it feels like a witch hunt to me. Every new piece of information that comes out just feels like people are trying to hang something, anything on the administration. You know, I know there were a lot of attacks in Turkey and Uzbekistan that didn't receive this kind of inquest. And so my question is, if this is really about future security reference, where was this inquest in every attack that we've had? It doesn't seem like it's there in this kind of veracity. It just seems they do seem like a dog with a bone. And I'm a registered independent. I'm not going to get in my voting record.
Yep.
But
it looks targeted to you.
Anything that's said anymore,
Mike. I appreciate your call as well. Okay, Mitch. There's Mary,
yep.
New Orleans, national catastrophe. Ought to be in the middle of the campaign. Larry in Connecticut saying, "Come on, comes with the territory, and let's not make this political." And then
You know, our Atlanta caller, Mike, this was witch hunt.
Yeah. I think this is a great sense of the stratosphere, the spectrum of opinions about this. And I respect all of their opinions. But the fact is, we don't know what really happened yet on the ground until the
purpose of this book. I thought you were telling us right here.
Well, I am. And that's the point, that the public has a right to know and a need to know how an American ambassador died and what were the circumstances surrounding that death and what were the circumstances surrounding the attempts and the heroic rescues that happened that night. I don't think I'm not going to own the witch
hunt.
But
you're not saying there's responsibility even for that 20 minutes, which our caller says maybe would have made the difference, maybe wouldn't have.
Well, one thing I will say responsibility
for. You're not getting that right to Washington.
One responsibility that I think the book makes quite clear is, and I think Mary made the point quite well, that the requests for extra security beforehand were denied. The ambassador asked for a site security team to remain multiple times. General Hamm from the African Command offered to keep these DOD, Department of Defense, active military members there in Libya, and they were denied.
Why? Was it a money issue? Was it an ignorance of threat issue?
I believe more the latter. The way it was explained by this Department of State was that they felt that they could handle it adequately on their own with their diplomatic security teams. And so, again and again, General Hamm asked Ambassador Stevens, do you want this? Do you want this? And even though Ambassador Stevens had asked for it, he wasn't going to try and overrule his own bosses at the State Department.
There's an amazing
that was
photograph,
a failure.
Amazing photograph late in this book of one of the six guys there, Mike Ozgeist, on a gurney being transported, from Libya to Germany. He's really got messed up here. And he's in the background on a gurney, on a bed, all kinds of medical stuff in the foreground, the casket of Ambassador Stevens. I guess this is on the transport plane.
That's correct.
Listen, here we are, 2 years this week later. We have all seen the images of Libya just coming apart. The guys swan diving into the U.S. compound and Libyans themselves facing all kinds of anarchy lately. We're going to hear in just a moment about the president's push for a strategy onward with the Islamic State. Did these guys fight and die in vain on that night? When you look at what's happening in Tripoli, maybe it's just, it has not come together in any kind of, great future for Libya way.
It's a fair question. The guys on the ground that night were not fighting to save Libya. They were fighting to save the Americans who were there, and they did that. They accomplished so much. There's no question. This would have been, used the phrase earlier, an Alamo. This would have been a modern Alamo were it not for this American security team. They made sure that the 25 or
so. How many did they save? 25?
The 25 or so Americans who were still there. Got out and were able to survive because over the course of the night in the annex, they're facing increasingly sophisticated attacks by rocket-propelled grenades and ultimately by mortars. The last two
followed them right back home to their CIA annex.
That's correct.
Where there was still death coming down.
Oh, from the sky. And a sophisticated attack by somebody with real military knowledge. And these guys held it together and they remained on the rooftops to the very bitter end.
Paramount has bought rights. Are they really going to bring this out in the middle of a campaign season? That would be political one way or another in itself.
What Hollywood does, I don't know, Tom, but I hope to see it on the film.
Mitch Zuckoff is author of 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. It's a gripping story. We'll see how it unfolds politically in this country. People weighing and listening right now to you, and our thanks as well to Chris Tantoporanto, who was there. Mitch Zuckoff, thanks very much for coming in. Great to see you.
Thanks very much, Tom.
In a moment, the president's strategy decisions on ISIS, the Islamic State. This is On Point. The Sunni extremist group ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, has torn its way through Syria and into an increasingly unstable Iraq. Many have died in their path, including two American journalists, beheaded. Late last month, President Obama said he had no strategy yet for countering ISIS. This week, he does. He's set to lay it out to the nation Wednesday night. NPR's Tom Bowman, national desk reporter covering the Pentagon, joins us now to look ahead toward the president's announcement and plans. Tom Bowman, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What is the president promising to deliver to Congress tomorrow and the country Wednesday night?
Well, we don't have a sense quite yet, but clearly part of this, a big part of this, is going to be training the Iraqi forces and providing more weapons to the Iraqi forces. and the other part will be the Syrian moderate rebels. They also want more training and weapons, so we'll have to see the way ahead on that. There are already hundreds of American military personnel in Iraq. They're doing assessments of the Iraqi army, how they're doing, how competent they are. They're also manning operation centers in both Baghdad and Erbil, providing intelligence, actionable intelligence, so they can strike some of these ISIS targets throughout Iraq. But again, the big part will be, what is the role of the U.S. in these training efforts? The president said no boots on the ground, but it looks like there will be some American trainers on the ground, perhaps trainers from other countries as well. So that's something to watch for when the president talks to the nation.
Here's a little bit of what the president had to say with Chuck Todd, the new host of Meet the Press. This was just yesterday, talking about what he would tell the country more broadly later this week, and right in the middle of this, saying this is not the equivalent of the Iraq War.
I'll make a speech and describe what our game plans are going to be going forward. But this is not going to be an announcement about U.S. ground troops. This is not the equivalent of the Iraq War. What this is similar to the kinds of counterterrorism campaigns that we've been engaging in consistently over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
NPR's Tom Bowman is with us. Tom, I want to parse some of that for a moment here. When he says it's similar to the kinds of terrorism campaigns we've been engaging in over the last 5, 6, 7 years, he's pointing to his own administration. He wanted out of Iraq. What's he talking about there?
Well, again, it could be some sort of trainers on the ground helping local forces. It could be drone strikes and airstrikes where you don't have American troops on the soil itself. It could be working with other countries, having them provide trainers and assistance. There are already some weapons going to the Kurds in northern Iraq. Germany sending some weapons. Some of the other countries are sending machine guns and mortars. So I think the president wants to have some assistance here from allies in Europe in particular, Germany, Italy, Britain, Albania even is taking part in all of this. And clearly he wants help from the Jordanians and the Saudis as well. I know Secretary of State John Kerry is reaching out to them.
I guess where I'm going with my question, my thinking here, is when he talks about things that have been going on, counterterrorism campaigns, Yemen comes to mind. Drones have been very active over Yemen. We've again and again, we've had American drone fire coming down, taking out leadership there, and they've talked about leadership this week. The administration, President Obama, has promised to degrade, destroy the Islamic State. Can that be done from the skies with the Kurds on the ground? Can you do a Yemen-style campaign here and take out a rather more substantial organization than al-Qaeda in Yemen, the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, first of all, you can't just do it from the skies. And it's important to know, Tom, that in Yemen, there are American Green Berets there training and working with the Yemenis. And in some instances, I'm told that American special operators have been flying in Yemeni troops to some of these locations. They've been doing it very quietly. There's so much focus, though, on Syria and Iraq that I don't think you could do this quietly. There's going to be a lot of focus on this in the coming weeks and months. So, no, you can't do it from the air. You're going to have to put some boots on the ground. You could say they're not combat troops. You can say they're not going to be fighting, but there'll likely be some troops, perhaps from the United States, clearly from other countries, advising these troops.
So the message to Americans on Wednesday night, it seems to me, I mean, we'll hear it from the president in detail, but he wants to say this is not another Iraq war, but yet you've got a coalition of the willing. You've got an organization, you know, you want to take out, which has got leadership you want to take out. You're going to be bringing in a lot of firepower, a lot of trainers, and arming up lots of folks next door. It's not a mass combat troop deployment, at least not now, but this is surely not a small thing if it's going to be successful.
No, it's not going to be a small thing. But I think what he'll say is we're not going to have large bases all over Iraq. I spent a fair amount of time in Iraq. At some of the bases, they're huge. There's all sorts of equipment and dining halls and everything else. They're not looking at that. They're not looking at tens of thousands of troops. And remember, at the end of 2011, the military initially wanted 15,000, 20,000 advisors for Iraq. After 2011, The president whittled it down reportedly to 3,000. I'm not even sure if you'll see those kind of numbers if they do come up with a train and assist mission for Iraq. So it will. He'll probably say it's going to take a long time. There will be American involvement. There'll be involvement from allies and partners in the region. And I think, he's going to try to keep this low-key from an American advisory position, because that's the key thing to watch for.
But is it doable? The promise is degrade, destroy. Is it doable with this kind of approach? What are you hearing from security analysts in Washington?
What they're saying is it's going to take a long time. Listen, the Islamic State is well entrenched now in parts of Syria, around Raqqa and central eastern part of Syria. They've taken Mosul, a city of 2 million people. They're in other large cities, Fallujah and Ramadi. Someone at some point is going to have to go in and root them out. It's very difficult. It's the hardest and worst kind of fighting, urban fighting. But it's unlikely you're going to see American troops go into those cities.
But who else? I mean, Kurds, they want their homeland, but do they really want to go into Syria?
Oh, no, no. No.
So who would be the boots on the ground if not American to go in and root them out?
In Syria, it would be the Syrian moderate rebels. They're few and far between. They've been asking for a lot more firepower and a lot more training. You could likely see the American military provide that training that's now being done by the CIA, provide that training in an industrial size effort somewhere in the Middle East.
Much more detail coming this week from the president to Congress tomorrow to the nation Wednesday night. Tom Bowman covers the Pentagon and more for NPR. Tom, thank you very much for joining us from Washington.
You're welcome, Tom.
Coming up tomorrow in this hour, an urgent plea for more help to slow the challenge, the Ebola challenge in West Africa. We'll look at it. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.